Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 15th of July. Our guest this hour has a three-part series on Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird and Go Set a Watchman. It's being published in the New Republic. We have read part one and part two of the series. Yesterday, we read the suspicious story behind Harper Lee's Go Set a Watchman, and today it's much more an analysis of To Kill a Mockingbird, the book, and it also looks at how relevant that story may be as we look at what happened in South Carolina, what happened with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin, Darren Wilson and Michael Brown. He also does a comparison of To Kill a Mockingbird and other books, so we'll be talking about that. It has created so much of a stir. I must confess that the book just came out yesterday, and I have not had a chance to read it yet, and I'll probably hold off just a little while in doing so. I certainly read the book in high school. I have four copies of the book at home, and I've seen the movie about 10 times, and the movie is very closely linked to the book and Gregory Peck's performance, which I thought was absolutely beautiful and moving. So we talk about all of that, and maybe somebody in the audience has had a chance to read the book already, because there were parties and book signings, not book signings, there were book readings last night in bookstores all over the country, and there's a lot of buzz about this book. William Giraldi is our guest. He is the contributing editor at the New Republic, and as I said, has written this three-part series published this week. He is the author of the novels Busy Monster and Hold the Dark, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, William. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Our pleasure to have you. Let's start with what I read yesterday that you had written, this announcement that the new Harper Lee novel has been discovered, and this is a story in itself, isn't it? There is just so much, so many questions to be asked as to when it was discovered and who discovered it and whether or not Harper Lee gave her permission to have this book published in the first place. What is the background here? What stories, what questions remain in your mind?
Well, as the New York Times first reported, back in February, when Tanya Carter, the lawyer for Harper Lee, announced that she had found this brand new book called Go Set a Watchman, and she was so stunned, it was how she worded it. And then, of course, as months went by, more and more questions came up as to how this was possible. And then, not long ago, the Times published, this was at the beginning of July, the Times published another article that said, in fact, it was discovered in 2011, that it was not found in 2014, as Tanya Carter, the lawyer, had originally said. A Sotheby's book appraiser went down to Monroeville to assess some of Harper Lee's archives for insurance purposes. And it was then in 2011 that the book appraiser and Ms. Carter and Harper Lee's agent at the time, all three discovered this manuscript that was titled Go Set a Watchman. And it took three more years for it to come to light, and there was questions as to why that was. Why was it that if, in fact, the lawyer discovered the book, the manuscript, in a bank vault in Monroeville in 2011, why wait until 2015, February of 2015, to tell the world? Well, I think the answer is clear, and that is that Harper Lee's sister protector, Alice Lee, who was an attorney and who bodyguarded her sister's interests steadfastly since 1960, since Mockingbird first came out, she was alive in 2011, and the question was, would she have allowed Ghost at a Watchman to be published. Would she have consented to this?
Yes.
I don't believe that she would have, and I know that a lot of others don't believe that she would have either. Charles Shields, Harper Lee's biographer, author of the book called Mockingbird, A Portrait of Harper Lee, the book is a model of research and rectitude. He was one who was very suspicious about the timing. Why wait till February of 2015 to announce this discovery if, in fact, as the Times reported, it was found in 2011? And so as far as what questions still remain in my mind, they've been the same questions all along, Kathleen. How is it that a writer who organized her life to avoid publicity, who vowed never to publish again after her experience with To Kill a Mockingbird, she left Monroeville for New York. She organized her entire existence to avoid the freshet of publicity that was soaking her that year and the following year, 60 and 61 into 62. How is it that all of a sudden in her 89th year, right, after her stroke of 2007, as she's confined to an assisted living establishment, how she decided that she was now ready to give the world what was clearly the first failed draft of To Kill a Mockingbird?
Mm-hmm.
And if you remember, there was a Newsweek headline during that initial sortie of coverage in February. And the Newsweek headline yelled, "Friends say Harper Lee was manipulated." I don't think that headline came as much of a surprise to anyone. I'm not sure that people with their consciences at the ready needed that headline. I think they already had those unignorable inner murmurs saying that something was indeed rotten in Monroeville.
And yet you have people from HarperCollins, this press release, saying that she did give her permission to this, that she is excited about this. We get all these reports, although there are also reports that nobody from the company, actually, the publishing company, has actually spoken to Harper Lee. They've spoken to her attorney.
That's correct. There was no contact with Miss Lee at all during these negotiations. A man named Michael Morrison, whose title is the president and publisher of HarperCollins U.S. General Books Group and Canada, it's a dizzying caravan of words, isn't it? Announced that Watchmen was a brilliant book, he said. He said it was a masterpiece that will be revered for generations to come. Jonathan Burnham, he is the senior vice president and publisher of Harper, which is an imprint of HarperCollins, called Watchmen a remarkable literary event. Of course they would. I mean, this is precisely what the kind of language that you would expect from businessmen who have quite a bit to gain from this this discovered manuscript. But you're right when you say that no one from the publisher had gone to negotiate or to ask Miss Lee in person. Everything had been relayed through her attorney, Tanya mm-hmm. Carter. In fact, the Times reported on February 3rd, in fact, on the day of the HarperCollins announcement, their announcement on their website about Watchmen, that this was going to happen. That same day, the Times ran an article that said Burnham, the senior vice president and publisher of Harper, said that he didn't find it necessary to speak to the author whose book he was buying, that he was completely confident, he said, that she had consented to the publication of Watchmen. He didn't find it necessary to consult the author of the book that he was buying, the book on which his outfit was about to make many millions of dollars.
Yes.
That strikes me as a little bit suspicious, more than a little bit. And I know I'm not alone with that. You have to remember that all of the statements that we've been given by Harper Lee have been attributed statements. They've all come through her lawyer. So that's something, too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So does this make you less likely to want to read this book? Does it have any influence on your reading this book or not?
You know, it's... I'm not a journalist. I'm a literary essayist. I write literary essays, and it has been difficult shutting out the commotion over this book, and to attempt to read it afresh, to attempt to read it with eyes that haven't been polluted by the business end of it, by the ethical end
yes.
of it. That has been something of a challenge, but for me, Kathleen, perhaps it's been less of a challenge than it would have been for some others. I'm not online very often. I don't participate in Facebook or Twitter or any other social media, and so I think I've done an okay job with my own reading of this book, uncontaminated by the commotion, and I've attempted to read it afresh and to assess it as I would any other book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not finished writing that assessment yet because I just got the book yesterday with most of America, and so I'm nearly finished reading it. I heard you say at the beginning that you haven't started it yet.
No, I don't have it.
But it's a little. I suspect it's going to be difficult for any reader to go to this book, to arrive at this book, to have a communion with this book that isn't, in some way, large or small, compromised by the media commotion and what we suspect is something of a moral dilemma here.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to remember, never let yourself forget, that Harper Lee had decades of good health to publish this manuscript if she had wanted to. Now, in one of the statements that was attributed to her, she said, "I was shocked to find that it still existed. I thought it had been lost." Well, as a novelist, I can tell you that novelists don't forget about the larval stages of their books. They don't forget about those gestational versions of their books. And if Harper Lee had indeed thought the book lost, all she had to do was look. It was right there in a bank vault in the town in which she lived.
Right.
The lawyer found it without trouble. The appraiser from Sotheby's found it without trouble. Her ex-agent found it without trouble. This was in 2011. So all she had to do was look if she thought it lost. She didn't think it lost. She knew where it was, and she chose not to publish it.
Well, I read somewhere over the weekend that she initially, after she was told to rework this back in 1957, took this manuscript and threw it out her window in her New York apartment, and somebody said, "Oh, you shouldn't do that. Please go retrieve it." And so she went downstairs to retrieve the pages that she had thrown out the window. If you've gone to that length to hold on to it, you don't lose it subsequently.
That's right. I read that as well, and I think you're right about that. She held on to this for the reason that any novelist holds on to a larval version of his book. It has a personal, it has a personal value, the same way that a photograph, say, of your child at 2 and at 3 and at 4 has value to you. So I think that's right. I think that she retrieved it. She held on to it. It followed her from New York to Monroeville after she fled New York. And there it remained. And now, of course, you're hearing that the lawyer has discovered a third book and perhaps a fourth book.
Right.
And I'm not I'm not looking forward to all that, I've got to say.
Right. Well, and also all of this happened suspiciously shortly after the death of Alice, her sister, who really took care of Harper Lee, it would appear to me from books I've read about their relationship. She looked out for her best interest all the time.
She really did. Alice Lee was something of a saint to her sister. She was her bodyguard, her counsel, her closest source of communion. And that is the question, isn't it? Alice Lee was alive in 2011 when the Sotheby's appraiser and the first agent and the lawyer discovered this manuscript, or let's say saw this manuscript. We keep saying discovered as if it's some kind of treasure that no one knew existed. Let's say what it was. It was seen in that bank vault. Alice Lee knew that it was there, and so did her sister. And so she was something of a she was a shrewd character, from what I understand. She was someone that you didn't mess with, and it looks as if the lawyer, this new lawyer, Tanya Carter, knew that. Of course, these are all appearances. This is how things look. It's very difficult to know exactly what the truth is. We have public statements that we can look at, and we could say that doesn't sound right. But that's all we can do. We don't know the truth here, and I think that that's part of the commotion. Mm-hmm. We all of us love a mystery, don't we?
Right.
And there is something mysterious here. How did this happen? This beloved American author, who vowed never again to publish, how is it all of a sudden in her 89th year that she's delighted? She was amazed.
Right.
She said that was the language attributed to her. She was amazed, and that doesn't strike me as Harper Lee language. Not the kind of language that we were accustomed to during decades of good health. She's amazed by what exactly? She's amazed that the very way of life that she's carefully constructed is about to be defiled, is about to be molested by a whole new barrage of publicity that hits my ear as distinctly false.
I share your concerns. William Giraldi is our guest this hour. He is writing, and sounds like he's reading, Ghosthead of Watchmen as well, a three-part series for the New Republic on all of the hoopla, the questions surrounding Ghosthead of Watchmen, that something doesn't ring true here about the publication of this book in terms of how enthusiastically Harper Lee endorsed the project when she has suffered from a serious stroke and can't see and can't hear, and yet she appears to be delighted by the publication. There are lots of questions surrounding that. And obviously a lot of money to be made from publication of the book. Does that shade your perspective as you, those of you who will read the book, do you think about the moral implications of the publishing of this book as you embark on your reading of it? And our guest is, the second part, has written a whole lot about To Kill a Mockingbird and looked at comparisons, trials that have taken place, and some of the issues that were very much a part of To Kill a Mockingbird, which keep resurfacing so many years after that book was printed. We'll talk about why that book is so prominent in American literary history. We'll talk about Harper Lee as a writer. He writes that, as some novelists know better than others, keeping paragraphs free of knee-jerk jargon and toneless formulations is the work of round-the-clock vigilance, and Harper Lee has always deserved more applause for the stride of her style. I think that is an apt description of the way that she writes. So we'll welcome your phone calls. Do you plan to read this book? Will all of the hoopla color your perspectives as you read it? Is it worthwhile for you to read this? The place of To Kill a Mockingbird in our history, and we will bring it up to date with current trials. And it's hard for me to separate the book and the movie sometimes, too. I'm not sure that William, I don't think he's seen the movie. I'll ask him that when we return. I would urge that he does see the movie, because Gregory Peck is just superb. was just watching clips again in the office this afternoon, and he is so good in that, I think. Here's how you join our conversation, and please do at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, Harper Lee, the controversy surrounding the publication of Go Set a Watchman, the importance of To Kill a Mockingbird, and we're welcoming your phone calls for our guest, 800-486-8655. We start with Robert in Green Bay. Hi, Robert.
Hi, I just have kind of an observation. I don't know if anyone has ever seen the movie with Sean Connery. It's called Finding Forrester, and it's a movie about a guy who wrote a real famous novel in like the 50s, and then became a recluse, never, you know, and lived off the money. The neighborhood changes. He ends up mentoring a black child that is also a writer, and then ends up having to come out of, you know, obscurity. And then when the movie ends, they found out that there was a second book. And that's how the movie ends, where there's a book that's found that he also had wrote a long time ago, and he only wrote one book. And I'm wondering if, you know, what they always say, that what is this, art copies life, whatever. This is like, this is almost like life copying the movie, but it's backwards. I don't wonder if anyone has seen that movie or saw that observation.
And what do you think about Go Set a Watchman, Robert? Will you look forward to reading it or not?
I don't know. Based on talking to your, you know, listening to your guest, I'm kind of not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because he doesn't sound like that she ever wanted it to come out.
William, yeah. What do you say about the reference?
Well, I know the movie that Robert's, to which Robert refers. I never saw it, but I do remember when it came out, and he's absolutely right. It's Sean Connery playing a hermetic writer who avoided all attention after a phenomenal success of a first novel. And there are a lot of parallels there, not just Harper Lee. Of course, you could reach to J.D. Salinger or to Thomas Pynchon. We've got a number of great American novelists who have decided to take themselves out of the game. And he's right. I hadn't thought of that, but this is eerily similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
To that film. But you know, I should say too, Kathleen, that Robert just said he wasn't sure whether he should read the book. I would urge him, and I would urge others to make up their own minds about it. I think that if they can shut out the media commotion and go to this book afresh and make your own determination. Do these sentences hold up? Do these characters hold up? Is this the same pen that gave us To Kill a Mockingbird? Are there similarities in the sentences? Are there similarities in the structuring of the novel, in the dialogue? Is the architecture similar? In other words, the maker of To Kill a Mockingbird, does this book strike you as the same maker or an earlier, a much earlier version of the maker of To Kill a Mockingbird? You've got to remember that this book, Go Set a Watchman, was 3 years earlier than,
yes,
To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, speaking as a novelist, I could tell you that 3 years, one goes through tremendous development, especially during those ages that Miss Lee was at the time, from 1957. When Go Set a Watchman was finished, until she was finished the revision of that book, which we now know of as To Kill a Mockingbird, she made tremendous improvements as a stylist and as a storyteller. And is it fair to be reading that amateur self? I mean, that's another bit of a problem that I had. I mean, I've got to write about Go Set a Watchman. I've got to review it as I would any other book, and I'm going to try to do that. Except it isn't like any other book, right? This author is still alive, and there are serious questions about whether she was in sound enough mind to consent to what has caused all of this commotion right now. And that's, I've got to say, that's a bit of a moral quandary for me. I'm reading something that when she was in sound health, chose not to give to me. I think most American consumers are going to not be too bothered by that. I think they're going to see this book as their right as American consumers. They love Harper Lee. They're Americans. It's for sale. They're going to buy it.
Absolutely.
And that's the end of the story.
I think you're right. Thank you. Thank you, Robert, for your call. I'll have to see that movie again. I remember now it was quite good. To reiterate your sentiments on this, Debbie from Cambridge emails, until we know for sure that Ms. Lee was not deceived regarding the publication of the book, that someone else is not profiting from this book and not the author herself, I will not be buying the book. I hope to read it at some point, but it will not be right now.
That's laudable. That's laudable indeed. I wish more Americans would feel that way. She's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Is she? She's a neighbor of mine. Then it seems.
It's Cambridge, Wisconsin. I think.
Oh, Cambridge, Wisconsin.
I don't know.
I'm sorry.
Massachusetts, but I think it's Wisconsin.
It's okay. Well, I'll tell you the Cambridge. The name is, it seems to be similar everywhere we go. All the Cambridges in the United States are great places. Let me say.
Right.
I quite agree with that.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's talk just a little bit before we go back to phone calls about To Kill a Mockingbird and the fact that after all these years after the publication of that book, we're talking about it once again. Books have been written about Harper Lee. Public television had this big documentary about it. The movie lives on for a long, long time. Why? What is it about this particular book? Is it the way that she writes? Was it the movie that was so wildly successful that put some remarkable performances on screen? What is it about this To Kill a Mockingbird?
So I think it's a confluence of factors, Kathleen. The movie certainly had something to do with it, but remember, the movie wouldn't have been made if the book hadn't been a phenomenal success in the first place. And so the book was a bestseller almost immediately. And for several years, there was a 2 or 3 year gap in between the publication of the book and the appearance of the film. The book was a steady bestseller. And so we can't just look at the movie and say that the reason this story is so encoded in our DNA is because of the film. Now, we've got to look at the book, and you asked if it's the way that the book is written, in other words, her prose style. And I wish that were true. I wish it were true that any novel with a beautiful prose style would be a phenomenal success. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Beautifully written books are published every day and forgotten just as fast. So it's something else. It's Mockingbird's ability to suction itself to our own nostalgia. I think that's the first part. And you've got to remember that the book is bifurcated, right? The book has a two-halved architecture, right? A halved architecture. And the first part is the childhood sublime, what I call the Wordsworthian childhood sublime of Scout and her brother Jem and their friend Dill, who is based on Truman Capote. Remember that Harper Lee and Truman Capote were childhood friends. And it is during that first half of the book that this childhood sublime is celebrated. This is when Dill and Jem and Scout are beguiled, beautifully beguiled by Boo Radley, by the hermetic, the shut-in neighbor, about whom there are all kinds of ghost stories told, vampire stories and boogeyman stories. And so the first act of the book is a vital imaginative prelude to the second half of the book, which, of course, is Atticus's unsuccessful defense of the wrongly accused and wrongly convicted black man Tom Robinson, convicted of the rape of Mayella Ewell. And so a lot of early critics in 1960 had a bit of trouble with that bifurcation. The New York Herald Tribune had trouble with it. Granville Hicks, who at the time was an important literary critic, a Marxist literary critic, but important nonetheless, had trouble with it. A scholar named W.J. Stuckey, it's an unimprovable name, isn't it? W.J. Stuckey.
Yes.
Had a problem with it. I think that idea that the book is really two books, that the second doesn't belong, has no nexus, has no umbilical to the first half, it goes a little bit out of its way to miss the point. That first half of the book, the celebrating of that childhood sublime, is absolutely necessary if we are to be affected by the destruction of that childhood sublime in the second half of the book. And that's what we see. That's what the trial and the conviction of Tom Robinson does to Scout and to Dill and to Jem. More so to Jem, I should say. Of the three children, it is Jem, the oldest, who's most affected, who's most defiled, really, by what he witnesses in that courtroom. And so there's that. There's the way that this book, the first half of it, attaches itself to our own nostalgia. I mean, the first half is really an exercise in nostalgia, and that's what makes it so beautiful, I think, is that it has a way of prompting, of titillating your own nostalgia.
Sure.
It's impossible to read that first half of the book and not think back with great sentimentality to your own childhood, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that, because we are all of us attached to our childhood. But, of course, that can't be the only reason the book has had such profound effects, such reverberations across the decades. And so we've got to look to the second half. And it's confrontation with race and with racial loathing and with the entrenched inequalities that lead to the suffering of the innocent and the killing of the innocent. And that's a little bit of what I tried to talk about in today's installment. Mm-hmm. For the New Republic. How does this book work on us? And I think that we can't discount that book, this, the second half especially. It makes us feel good about where we are with race relations in this country, right? Atticus is in the world, and as long as there are Atticuses in the world, all will be well. And although this didn't turn out the way that we hoped, even though Tom Robinson was convicted, and even though he was shot to death trying to escape the prison yard, which, by the way, I never believed that official line. I never could quite buy that this very gentle one-armed man, or shall we say one-and-a-half-armed man, was escaping from the prison. I mean, he was shot 17 times by a prison guard. No doubt white prison guards. Of course, they were white prison guards. Black prison guards weren't allowed at the time. 17 shots is a bit too much. Those were men who were incensed over the rape of a white girl, a rape that, of course, never happened. And so the book works on our own, I have to say, lazy consciences, right? It doesn't demand very much of us. We sit back, we read Mockingbird, and we feel quite good about the upstanding personality, about the rectitude of Atticus Finch. He's a wholly good character, right? It's what makes him a touch unbelievable, or shall we say, not credible, that he is so morally flawless, right? And by the way, I think that if you look closer at the second half of that book, he isn't quite as morally flawless as he is supposed to be. I think that it's something of a major flaw for Miss Lee to have constructed his character in such a way that he is given the case of Tom Robinson. In other words, the defending of that man was not really his choice. He was given that assignment by Judge Taylor. I think that Lee should have constructed that character in a way in which he demanded to have that assignment, not because it was his profession, but because it was his obligation.
We're going to welcome more phone calls, and here is how you reach us. We're talking about the novel itself, this part of the hour, To Kill a Mockingbird, and what it is, you know, a critique of the novel and also an explanation of why it has stayed with us so long, so that we are upset by something else that has its own set of moral considerations, whether or not the author wanted her earlier work, Ozetta Watchman, to be released. So that colors your perception of reading this. But also looking at the issues of race, the frailties of this novel, the strengths of this novel, and welcoming your phone calls. It's become very much discussed this week. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And before we take more of your phone calls, I did want to play a little bit of the movie version of To Kill a Mockingbird, because it was a absolutely very moving performance by Gregory Peck. And I think that we also get the image. Now we have a screen image of Atticus that has stayed with us because it was so powerfully done by Gregory Peck. And here's part of what he had to say in the courtroom. And this is the image that we don't want to let go of, understandably.
She did something that in our society is unspeakable. She kissed a black man, not an old uncle, but a strong, young, Negro man. No code mattered to her before she broke it, but it came crashing down on her afterwards. The witnesses for the state, with the exception of the sheriff of Macon County, have presented themselves to you gentlemen, to this court, and the cynical confidence that their testimony would not be doubted. Confident that you gentlemen would go along with them on the assumption, the evil assumption, that all Negroes lie, all Negroes are basically immoral beings, all Negro men are not to be trusted around our women. An assumption that one associates with minds of their caliber, and which is in itself, gentlemen, a lie, which I do not need to point out to you. And so, a quiet, humble, respectable Negro who has had the unmitigated temerity to feel sorry for a white woman has had to put his word against two white peoples. The defendant is not guilty, but somebody in this courtroom is.
Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch. We'll return and continue conversing with our guest and with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to more phone calls now. Joe in Wapaka. Hi, Joe.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just in response to your guest's mentioning of Atticus Finch being so flawless, I think that's appropriate. It was being told from the viewpoint of his daughter, a little girl. And so in her eyes, in many ways, he was flawless. So I'm really looking forward to reading the sequel, or the next book, I should say, because now we're going to see Atticus Finch through the eyes of a young adult. And so I think that change is going to make a more complete character of Atticus Finch. So your response, please.
Well, thank you, sir, for that comment. I should say that we should make a distinction between the child's point of view and the scout's point of view in To Kill a Mockingbird and Jean Louise Finch's point of view. I don't think that what we have in To Kill a Mockingbird is a child's point of view. I think that we see the book through her eyes, but I think that the language and the mind is wholly the adult Jean Louise Finch's. And so that, by the way, was something that early reviewers were not pleased with. They thought that the perspective, that the point of view bounced back and forth between the child, Scout, and the adult Jean Louise Finch. That doesn't ever really happen. The point of view is consistent throughout. They are the eyes of this little girl. It is true, but the language and the mind is that of the adult. And so that's something that I think needs to be stressed. We have a bifurcated structure of the book, right? But we don't have a bifurcated point of view of the book, by which I mean this language is not a child's language, right? The remembrances, the nostalgia it belongs to the child. But as I say, the linguistic power and the power of mind both belong to a sophisticated adult woman who we suspect has left the South. She doesn't have very good things to say about that way of living. She's got a great line where she talks about the preachers going off on their impurity of women rant, that they seem always to unburden themselves of, right? I mean, that's an adult perspective and quite a sophisticated one, I think. So that should be said.
I think that sometimes, too, we need to look at this particular book. I was alive when the book came out, and I remember, you know, what the country was like in terms of race relations. Not that it's much better now, and I think you really poignantly and dramatically talk about fitting To Kill a Mockingbird in today's discussions about the massacre in South Carolina, et cetera, which we'll talk about. But when you think about the impact that it had on this country, in the early 1960s, civil rights demonstrations, marches on Washington, bombings of churches in the South, the death of people in civil rights marches, pre-legislation, pre-Lyndon Johnson's, Great Society and civil rights bills. It had an impact, I think, on a whole lot of Americans who didn't see that. And I think they saw some of it, even though To Kill a Mockingbird is set much earlier, that here you had it on screen and here you had it in a book, and you paid attention to an issue that maybe you hadn't paid attention to before.
There's something there, yeah. I think that can't be denied. I was born 14 years after this book was published. I don't have the memories that you have. What I do have are memories of what has been happening over the past couple of years, and it is remarkable that you can go and reread To Kill a Mockingbird, and especially that second half, and to see how little has changed.
Right.
I'm referring, of course, to what we witnessed with Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, with Michael Brown and Darren Wilson, what we saw with Freddie Gray in Baltimore, the on-camera killing of Walter Scott as he ran away from a South Carolina police officer. And as you mentioned, Kathleen, the massacre that we saw in June in the Charleston, South Carolina church, the assassination of 9 peaceful human beings for the crime of having
a dark epidermis. And it was reported that this butcher, you'll forgive me if I don't utter his name, I will not, the butcher, before he opened fire, is reported to have said, "You rape our women." And, of course, that's exactly what Tom Robinson is accused of in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
And so that's what I mean. You see that in certain respects, the entrenched inequalities, we still have not dug them out. I do find it distasteful that it took the assassination of those 9 peaceful human beings in order to force the politicians of South Carolina to sprout a conscience and to pack up a omni-bigoted and insurrectionist flag. That is, to my mind, a sickening cost to do something that should have been done long, long ago.
Long time ago. Ray in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Sure. I want to have 2 parts to my statement here. The first one, I'm going to talk about the book. This is fascinating. I'm really glad you're having this discussion, and this is a perfect time for it because of what our country seems to be regestating all over again. And then my second part of my statement, after the guest has commented on my first part, I'd like to just reflect on living in North Carolina in a little town called Tabor City, North Carolina, in the mid-70s. So I want to start with the book. I want to look at it as an artist. The author is also an artist, and I'm fascinated by any great artist who I can see an earlier sketch of their great masterpiece. For instance, sketches of the Mona Lisa or of some great music score. I'd love to see the earlier sketches, and whether or not she wants it to be released is a whole different observation for me, because I have never read To Kill a Mockingbird. I've seen the movie, but now I want to read this book first and then go and read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, that's interesting. I have to hold you to one comment, Ray. We have a lot of calls and very little time. William.
Well, each reader is going to have to make up his own morals about that. I think that we have to ask ourselves, do we have the right to this book, just because we can go to a store and put down American cash for it, does that mean that it is our right? I think that we have to go back to the question of whether or not this artist, and the caller is absolutely right to say artist. That is precisely what Harper Lee is, and her art is hers. It is her book, her name on the cover of this book, not anyone else's, right? And it is indeed fascinating. Of course, it's fascinating, and there wouldn't be a problem if we could be sure that this is what she wanted. But the problem is, we can't be sure that this is what she wanted, and so that's where the dilemma enters the story, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Ray, thanks, Robert in Amherst Junction. Quickly, we're almost out of time. I'm sorry, Robert.
That's all right. I think this bifurcated story is interesting. When I read it as a student, of course, it was put in the frame of race relations. When I read it as a parent and a professional, I really got into the character of Atticus Finch as a lawyer. He was a lawyer. He was logical. He believed in justice. The way that he raised Scout and the decisions he made, and the way that he maintained a certain parenting style, even against his sister's wishes and some other people being judgmental about the way that he raised his kids. So there's so much of the story that I don't see it as bifurcated. It builds the character.
Thank you, Robert, very much for your call. And on that note, we're going to have to say goodbye. William, thank you. Part 3 comes out when? Tomorrow?
Part 3 will be out tomorrow. Yes,
great.
Kathleen.
Thank you, William. William Giraldi, contributing editor at the New Republic, author of the novels Busy Monsters and Hold the Dark. He has a 3-part series in the New Republic on the controversy about the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. He's reading Glossetta Watchman now, and there's also a piece that's an analysis of To Kill a Mockingbird.